Well, I want to welcome you all here today. My name is Mark Scholl. I'm the chairman of the board of the Farm Foundation and NFP. We sincerely appreciate you taking the time to visit today with the panel that we have. 10 years ago, one of our members, Congressman Charlie Stenholm, was talking at one of our meetings about that there's wasn't a good place in Washington, D.C., to talk about the issues of agriculture and bring the stakeholders together. So at that meeting, we decided to try to figure out some way to improve that, and we began with the were the forums that we are holding here today. So we've had thousands of people on numerous issues, whether it's animal health, whether it's trade policy, whether it's finance, you name it, we've had some type of forum that relates to that. So today, we're happy to have a panel here with us that's going to talk about an issue that is very germane and something that is of great importance to the rural life, and that is the cost of poverty in rural America today. We have a panel today with Mr. Bill Bynum. Bill is with the is the CEO of the Hope Enterprise Corporation of Jackson, Mississippi. Bill. We have Jason Henderson, the Director of Extension at Purdue University. Our third panelist, many of you know already, is the USDA Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack. I had the pleasure about 15, 20 years ago to first meet Secretary Vilsack. I was starting a business, and we were looking to where we could go to put a laboratory. And I don't know if it was your first day, but it was one of your first days as the governor of Iowa, and he took the time to come and visit with my board and talk about the great merits of the state of Iowa and what could be done there at the university systems that they have. Well, at that time, it became very clear to me that his passion for agriculture, his understanding and capability to look at where we're at and where we're going was above and beyond. And I think we've seen, and I continue to be impressed, with the work that he does through the USDA to continue to look at the issues that are germane to this great thing we have called agriculture, from soup to nuts, the value chain of ag. So with that, I'd like to welcome Secretary Vilsack, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning with all of you, and certainly look forward to the discussion with my colleagues here on the panel. 85% of America's more persistently poor areas where poverty rates exceed 20% and have historically exceeded 20% are located in rural America. The reality is one out of every four children who live in rural America live in poverty. The president is quite concerned about that. I'm quite concerned about it. And frankly, I think all Americans should be concerned about it because the importance of rural America plays in the lives of every single American. This is the place where most of your food comes from. A good deal of the water that you drink is impacted by what goes on in rural America. Almost all the feedstock for the energy that we consume in this country is derived from rural America. And in every audience I talk to, I point out that a disproportionate number of young people who are serving the military come from those rural communities. So it is something that we want to deal with, and it is something that we have dealt with over the last 7 years in a fairly creative, innovative, and comprehensive way. I'm going to try to touch briefly on some of the innovation and creative thoughts that we've had in terms of dealing with poverty and economic opportunity in rural America, and I will probably spend a little bit of time on four pillars that we are focused on in terms of rebuilding the rural economy with a significant emphasis on local and regional food systems. But let me begin by the innovative approach. The president believed, and I believe he is correct, that we need to have a coordinated focus effort among all federal agencies that impact and affect rural America. So that's why he established for the first time ever a rural council. He asked me to chair that council. It's all the federal agencies that have anything to do with rural America. We work in a coordinated and integrated fashion to try to address the issues involved with rural America. Our first 4 years, I think we focused primarily on economic opportunity. We created a variety of programs, from job accelerators to using the Farm Credit or Farm Service Agency offices as a place to provide information about Department of Labor programs, to a innovative and creative partnership between the Department of Energy, the Department of the Defense, and our department, USDA, to develop a drop-in aviation and marine fuel industry in order to support the Navy's desire to have one half of their fuel needs being met by domestically produced biofuels. We've looked for a number of creative ways to try to create economic opportunity. When I pointed out to the president that one out of every four children in rural America lives in poverty, he authorized and directed the Rural Council to address that issue. And we are looking at a very creative two-generation solution in 10 communities across rural America in our rural impact effort, which is designed to really look at ways in which we can deal with both issues involving children in poverty and families in poverty, working together and coordinating our programs so that mom and dad and child get assistance and help. This is going to be evaluated over the course of the next couple of years, and we're hoping to be able to identify strategies that really work effectively to deal with the issues of poverty for children. We think we're going to learn a lot from this two-generation approach, and we're already beginning to see youngsters having better access to preschool, parents having information about worker training and job opportunities that didn't exist before. As an adjunct to that, the president also has expressed concern to me and to his cabinet about the high level of opioid use in rural America. And the reality is that, again, we see a disproportionate number of addictions and poisonings occurring in rural America. The suicide rate, which is, I think, a function of many, many issues, for white males in particular, is significantly higher in rural areas than it is in urban centers. So the president has instructed an aggressive, comprehensive effort at addressing the issue of opioid abuse, ranging from making sure that we have access to reversal drugs, encouraging states to better monitor prescriptions, encouraging more training on the part of physicians in the prescribing and dentists in the prescribing of these opioids, making sure that we expand access to medication-assisted treatments, which we know work, making sure that if we can't provide in-person behavioral service centers, brick and mortar in rural areas, that we use telemedicine creatively to provide access to specialists, and making sure that we provide appropriate guidelines in the use of opioids. All of this, I think, is part of a concerted, integrated effort. At USDA, we've taken that same concept in our Strike Force initiative, which is looking at 900 counties or so that are persistently poor, and understanding that many of those counties do not have the personnel, the sophistication to be able to access or even know about the many federal programs designed to help them at USDA. So we've created a team of folks at USDA across our mission areas that go into these counties. They work with a community building organization. We now, in the 900 counties, have over, I think, 1,500 partners that we're working with. We've made over 190,000 investments in those persistently poor areas, over $23 billion, housing, job creation, community facilities, conservation, farm loans, a wide variety of investments in those areas. And we're beginning to see those areas better understand how to utilize USDA programs. And the concept of Strike Force was then extended by the administration in its Promise Zone effort across the federal agencies, where we have designated a number of rural communities and tribal areas as Promise Zones, where we're giving them more technical assistance and information to be able to access the programs that will help them turn things around. Let me just very briefly touch on the four pillars, and then I'll be glad to turn it over to my colleagues here. You know, in order to really address the issues of poverty, you have to understand what's happened in rural America, which is that our agricultural economy is one of the most innovative, creative, and productive economies in the world. We basically have an economy, an agricultural economy that supplies all of our needs in the United States and provides an opportunity for us to export. It has been incredibly productive in my lifetime, 170% increase in productivity. That's an amazing statistic, but it's even more amazing when you consider that it's on 26% less land with 22 million fewer farmers. Over my lifetime, we've gone from about 25 million farmers to a little over 2 million farmers. And if you really look at the people that produce most of what we consume and most of what we need, it's about 250,000 farmers, about 0.1% of our population. The sad reality in rural America was, and until recently, that we did not overlay the production agricultural economy, that extraction economy, As people were moving off the farm, as we didn't need as many farm families, we didn't provide opportunities for those who were leaving the farm to be able to stay, live, work, and raise their families in rural areas until recently. But we have now developed a strategy, and that strategy involves a commitment to production agriculture and exports. That's why the president, I think, believes strongly in the trade agreement that's pending before Congress. It's also conservation focused on increasing habitat for outdoor recreation, which is a $650 billion industry. More of that has to be spent and invested in rural areas, and we have to create more opportunities for Americans to recreate in rural areas. The bio-based economy, converting everything that we grow and raise, even waste product that's produced during the production process, and converting it into chemicals and materials. It, too, is a growing industry, over $350 billion industry, employs nearly 4 million people today. We're just getting started in creating that aspect of the American economy. And then finally, the local and regional food system, where we've made over $1 billion of investment in creating an infrastructure from microloans to extending the growing season with tunnel houses to increasing the number of market opportunities through farmers markets, farm to school, a wide variety of restaurants that are using locally and regionally produced food. It's an opportunity for us not only to help those small entrepreneurs, not only to repopulate the rural areas, but also it's a good entryway as we deal with the aging population of our farm community. Average age of American farmers, 58. We are now encouraging young people, even those who have not had a lot of involvement in agriculture, to be interested in agriculture. And we're seeing this as an exploding and expanding opportunity. It was around $5 billion industry in 2008. In 2014, it was about $12 billion. And it's projected to go to $20 billion industry in 2019. So there's an opportunity now for the 162,000 farm families that are involved in this movement to continue to expand and continue to operate profitably by virtue of their ability to dictate their own price to their customer. So we have a strategy, we have innovative approaches, and we are also trying to address and deal with the consequences of poverty, whether it's the impact on children or whether it's the sad reality of excessive opioid use and heroin use. This administration has taken the concerns and the needs of rural America extremely seriously, and I would say with some confidence that probably since the New Deal, there has been not as much attention or investment in rural America under any previous administration, with the exception of perhaps the Johnson administration, than this administration. There has been record amounts of investment in business, community facilities, and infrastructure to help support this effort. And the bottom line is we're seeing a downturn in the unemployment rate, which is good. We're seeing a slight decline in the child poverty and poverty rates among children, decelerating at a rapid rate, more rapidly than in the last 25 years. And we're beginning to see, even with low commodity prices, that family farm income, which includes non-farm and off-farm income, is projected to be at a record high this year. So despite the difficulties and challenges we have in the agricultural economy itself, the ability that we're creating of additional job opportunities is helping to support families in rural areas. So I look forward to your questions and look forward to hearing from the other two presenters today.
So I'm going to take just a few minutes and talk a little bit about the North Central region. The Secretary has talked about the national the priorities. So I'm going to talk about child poverty in rural America. Recent study out of Purdue, and why are we focused on child poverty? Huge risk in child poverty as they even continue into adulthood. It's the persistence of it. Various different things are happening of how that foundation of what they lived in and the situation they lived in, the families, if they're at a disadvantage in there. Those that had a child in financial disadvantage with their families associated with more health risk and problems in social functions as they went through later in life, whether it was lower educational attainment, reduced friend support, lower social integration, higher incidences of smoking, drug abuse, it was mentioned before, increased family strain, and just generally just more health problems on a variety of fronts and diseases, and over 31 different diseases they looked at. It has lasting impacts. And I think where it is because what you learn as a child is the foundation for your future, right? And so in many different ways, it puts you on a trajectory. And which trajectory are you going to be on, and the advantages and disadvantages that you do have. I think when we look at the North Central region, and I'm looking at this as coming from Purdue University in Indiana, our 12 directors in the North Central region are focusing on poverty, looking at what Extension can do to be a partner and assist in addressing this issue. And for us, when we look at poverty, there's the overall poverty rate, but it's the child poverty rate. And what you see is that the child poverty rate in the North Central area is much higher. And this is looking at data from 2009 to 2013. This was a time when there's a great economic boom on the farm, right? But at the same time, poverty rates increased during this decade. Total population in poverty increased from 10% to almost 15%. Minors in poverty reached almost 20%. And all the in a larger concentration in non-metro communities. And so in many different ways, because there was economic opportunity of what was happening on the farm, it didn't always translate into economic opportunity throughout the rest of the community. And it was really challenging. And I think from my standpoint, it's because of this bifurcation of the economy, however you want to do it, or in the language that I like to use, we have haves and have-nots. We have people that have been able to embrace and take advantage of the economic opportunities and bring opportunities to their children, and those that have struggled to do it. And for a wide variety of reasons. Whether it's economic and because of the community they look in, whether it's the skill sets that they had and they attained in terms of how could they reach the economic and be involved in the local economy, whether it was family structures and challenges that they faced, but a wide variety of different reasons and rationales for different places to happen. And for us, when we look at child poverty at Purdue, we look at it as multidimensional. Studies on it really focus on the intergenerational mobility of economic status. Some of the underlying underpinnings of it come from two basic sources. It's the family, it's parenting, it's structures, it's the ability to make investments in your children. So the second one is communities. What's about the education, the safety, the jobs, career readiness? A lot of things that we're doing at Purdue now have launched a couple of different things to really focus on what we want to do to help address child poverty. Number one, we've been looking at the issue on drug abuse. But instead of focusing on drug abuse and dealing with the symptoms, we've implemented two programs at Purdue here recently, borrowing from our sister extension agencies, one from the University of Nebraska and one from Iowa State University, that focus on parenting. Because if you strengthen families and you build communication between teenagers and parents, it's been proven to reduce teenage drug use. In fact, the Strengthening Families program, for every dollar invested in that program, has saved $9.60 through reduced drug use, through reduced jail time, through other types of social problems. It has some lasting impacts. So focusing on some of the root causes of strengthening families and building that framework. Because I don't know about you, but I have twin girls that are 13, and parenting is just hard. And so in many different ways, we've got to figure out how do we go about addressing families and providing the support that they need. The second thing is we're focusing on communities. Because it's about opportunities and creating economic opportunities in that community, but it's also, for us, it's about career readiness for children and young adults. It's how do we get them ready for the careers of tomorrow. And at the university, we talk a lot about STEM, the science and technology and engineering and the mathematics, and about getting them ready. But at Purdue, our focus has been on experiences. I don't know how you learned, but I learned by breaking things and trying to get them fixed before my dad got in from the field. And so it's the experiences of learning and getting your hands dirty and getting it together that allows us to build those experiences and learning opportunities where you have to be a little creative. It means that you're going to be a little bit more innovative and doing different things. And how do we go about doing that? I think for us, because we run 4-H, it's linking 4-H to careers and linking 4-H to majors and different projects that they do. It's about creating what we've done recently, a makers workshop, which was an idea that we borrowed from an extension agency out west, where we brought youth in, put them in a big room in an engineering building, and gave them things, blocks to build with. We gave them electronics to build robots. We even gave them a computer, a banana, and circuits, and told them to create a piano. And they did it. But how do you get them those opportunities and experiences to do things in many different ways? And for a lot of times, the children in poverty, the challenge they have is, what type of experiences do they experience? Or what types of experiences do they miss out of? And if by giving them experiences, do we give them a vision of a new future? Something that's different, so that they can see a different path to where they're going and a different future. And so for us, I think we need to have programs that are holistic. It's focusing on communities, it's focusing on families, and it's focusing on children and youth. We have some examples that have been working that the Farm Foundation has invested in already. And it's taking those and evaluating them and figuring out what works and figuring out what we can do even better. And the Community Development Society is getting ready to release a sole journal on child that's turning the tides on poverty and some of the benefits and some of the opportunities that we have in the future. So I think for us, it's thinking about it holistically and how we can provide experiential-based opportunities for children and young adults just to get them to see a different path forward from what they've experienced before. Thank you.
Thank you. I think my comments will dovetail quite a bit on the previous remarks that have been made. Just to give you a little context, my name is Bill Bynum. I am the CEO of HOPE. HOPE Enterprise Corporation is a loan fund. HOPE Credit Union is a regional financial institution. And HOPE Policy Institute is a policy center that all focuses on providing resources to improve lives in Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Tennessee. We've been doing this for roughly 22 years in the what is arguably one of the nation's most impoverished regions. The Secretary talked about persistent poverty. I'll talk a bit on that. And I think what Jason said about holistic solutions is absolutely critical. Child poverty in our region is among the worst in the country, roughly. Mississippi and Louisiana rank 48th and 49th in the country in terms of child poverty. If you drill down deeper for African Americans, it's hovering around 50% for black children in those areas. But you can't talk about child poverty without talking about multi-generational poverty. If a family's poor, then the kids are going to be poor. And so we look very comprehensively at the work that we do. You can't have a discussion about rural poverty and multi-generational poverty without talking about persistent poverty. Depending on which data set you use, there are between 350 and 384 persistent poverty counties in the country, 900 communities. I think it's certainly a distressing situation. The fact, though, is that persistent poverty is concentrated, as the Secretary said, in rural areas. Almost two-thirds of the persistent poverty counties in the country are in the old Confederacy. One-quarter of the nation's persistent poverty counties are in our footprint, in Arkansas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. And when you look at persistent poverty, it's impossible to ignore the interrelationship between race and persistent poverty. In the Mid-South, there are 39 persistent poverty counties. 35 of those are majority black. But when you look at persistent poverty across the country, what you see is significant concentration in the Colonias, which has a large Hispanic population, in Indian country, in the Dakotas, in New Mexico, in Arizona, in Appalachia, which is obviously majority white, So when you paint a picture of persistent poverty, it's a picture of America, and it's an America that is growing increasingly diverse. And so investing in these communities in a strategic and focused way is critical to addressing issues facing persistent poverty. But when you drill down and look at almost any indicator of economic and social well-being, you can't ignore the symbiotic relationship between persistent poverty and these conditions. When you look at maps of the Mid-South, this is Mississippi, Arkansas, and Louisiana, you see that persistent poverty areas are where you have the lowest quality school performance. It's also noteworthy that 77% of the majority white counties in the Mid-South in Mississippi have school districts are rated A or B, and only 6% of the majority black census tracts in persistent poverty counties are they rated A or B. So these discrepancies are significant. These counties that are persistent poverty have the worst health outcomes, and the lowest 25% rank health ratings in the state, in the region. We have the highest rankings of unbanked residents and high-cost mortgage lending. If you look at where assets and wealth is in the country, it's still the primary source of wealth and abilities of a parent to support their family, to generate equity, to start a small business, to send their kids to school, is in the home. But when you have lack of bank branches, when you have high-cost predatory lenders that dominate these communities in a disproportionate rate, then you limit the ability of these communities to pull themselves up the economic ladder. You have the highest rates of unemployment. And again, as I mentioned, there are higher concentrations of communities of color in these persistent poverty areas. Fortunately, though, solutions to these challenges don't require rocket science. For the past 20 years at HOPE, we have been working in these areas to bring resources into the areas that need it most. We work quite closely with federal agencies to do this whenever that's possible. One example is a rural hospital in Centerville, Mississippi, Field Memorial Hospital. The hospital was 60 years old, debilitating, leaking roofs. It was just outdated. It wasn't a place that anyone felt good about bringing their loved ones for care. We were able to work with the Federal New Markets Tax Credit Program. It's a program that was created to attract capital into distressed communities. President Clinton launched it actually in Clarksdale, Mississippi in June 1999 with bipartisan support by then Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott. We were able to use those resources to bring a new facility to a place where it's a persistent poverty county. Three of the four patients were on Medicaid, Medicare, or uninsured. It's a major source of employment in these communities, and we were able to work with banks, work with federal and state government, and bring capital in and renovate that facility. We would like to do more of this, but unfortunately, many programs often miss the mark in terms of targeting persistent poverty rural counties. Case in point, Maine. Maine has zero persistent poverty counties. It has gotten three times the new market tax credit allocations as Mississippi, which has 48 of its 82 counties that are persistent poverty. We've got to do a better job of aligning resources with those communities and people and places that need it most. This was a huge win for a rural community. We can do more of this. I really think that community development financial institutions, I'm biased because we are one, but there are community development financial institutions in every state across the country. They are essentially the Swiss Army knife of community development in many cases. They work under the radar to target resources into those communities that need it most. Of our mortgages, almost 90% of our mortgages were made to first-time home buyers at a time when many lenders are pulling out of these markets. We have tripled the number of bank branches of credit union branches in persistent poverty counties in the Mid-South since the recession, at a time when across the country over 2,000 bank branches have closed, 93% of them in low-income communities. I think there are opportunities for collaboration between organizations that are on the ground that know how to target these resources where they're needed most, but to Jason's point, these organizations need capacity building. I think there are significant opportunities for collaboration with agencies. USDA has $200 billion portfolio that has been targeted to rural businesses, rural housing, community facilities, infrastructure. It is the largest development bank in the country. I think there are opportunities for partnerships between USDA and organizations like ours that are located in Appalachia, in the Colonias, in Indian Country, in rural areas. One of the challenges of this, though, I think, is how resources are allocated. Policy decisions are about choices. I think we all know that poverty is not a red or blue issue. As you can see from the maps of persistent poverty across the country, it's not a black, white, or brown issue. It's an American issue, I think. Fortunately, we know what these communities need, what they want. They want the same things that we all want for our families and loved ones. They want a good education. They want solid housing. They want stable communities to help support their families. They want jobs. They want quality health care. I think we have shown that when with strategic investment, you can make these, you can bring these resources to bear in community of that are persistent poverty, but it takes intentional focus effort. And I really appreciate the fact that we're here having this conversation, and Secretary, I really appreciate your leadership on these issues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, there are a couple of points I want to just to add on. On this issue of targeting resources, at USDA, we ask our teams to report back to us in rural development how much of the resources are actually being invested in those persistently poor areas. And we set a target initially that we wanted 20% of our resources in rural development focused on the 20% of the, or 30%, 20% of the 20% of our resources in 20% of the counties that have a poverty rate of 30% or more. And what we found was that we actually exceeded that goal. So now we are working towards 25%. And so we are keeping track of that. And then on the CDI, there's a very creative idea that we are working on in which we're going to flip the concept of loaning. Right now, as you know, we have loan guarantees where we guarantee a bank's loan. We've done over a million home loans, and many of them are guaranteed loans since I've been secretary. What about the possibility of the private sector guaranteeing some of our loans to the CDFIs so they in turn can use their relending capacity? So in other words, reducing the risk to the taxpayer by having the private sector come in and guarantee. So sort of flip the script here a little bit. And we think we're onto something here. We think we can put more resources into CDFIs by doing it that way.
I think that's very exciting. I think that's exactly the kind of innovation that's needed because CDFIs, community organizations that are on the ground in these communities, have a much greater ability to target those resources to places and people where they're needed most. Mm-hmm. I think the challenge is we don't have large foundations, we don't have mega banks that invest in these communities the way that larger urban areas have. We don't have, the states don't have the resources to funnel into community development that's needed to turn around these communities. But I think if we can be more innovative in partnering, leveraging those private resources and federal resources, mm-hmm. then you know, you start to improve the economy and generate a tax base that can actually invest in education at higher levels.
Right.
And I think the ripple effects will be significant.
So I'm going to, at this time, open it up for questions that people would have here in the room. And also, if you're listening to us from a different location, please send in your questions at any point in time, and we'll get those addressed. So first question here. And could you please come to the microphone and for the external audience? And feel free to state your name.
Here you are. My name is Jim Webster. I'm a journalist, former Agriculture Department official. been following these issues for 40-some years. About 2 weeks ago in the Washington Post, there was a magnificent story, a terrible story, about a woman in Oklahoma who died at the age of 54 after drinking a liter of vodka a day. Mm. A Woman Without Hope is a long story. Her name was Mariana. I'll never forget it. Eli Saslow was the writer. I sent him an email afterwards, and I asked one question. Where was the church? I would ask you all the same thing. Where is the church in trying to alleviate the problems of persistent poverty?
Well, I can address the specifics on our one of the implications of poverty, which we mentioned, is opioid use. And the White House convened not too long ago a conference call with faith-based leaders. And the task for that conference call, and I followed up with an additional conference call, the task was for those faith-based leaders in rural areas to create the environment in which there can be community support for recovery. And the reality is, in rural areas, there may not be a location or locations for AA meetings and things of that nature. If you're attempting to recover from an addiction, you can't just cold turkey. You really have to be surrounded by a lot of people helping you. You have to have physicians helping you. You've got to have behavioral science and mental health professionals helping you. But you also have to have the person who's gone through the same thing you've gone through to be able to tell you that on those difficult days when you're tempted to take a pill or take a drink, to avoid that temptation to move on. You got to be able to pick up the phone and call someone. Well, if you don't know where those people are in your community, if you don't have any place where you can gather and share stories, it becomes extremely difficult to have that kind of recovery. So we're asking faith-based leaders to open up the churches, open up the community meeting facilities, opening up the parish halls, to have those kinds of opportunities take place in rural areas. So that's one aspect of it. I think, you know, obviously in our world, in USDA, we do a lot of nutrition work, and I would say that the faith-based community has stepped up in a significant way to assist us in terms of reducing the impacts of food insecurity among many of these rural families. They help to lead the food drives. They help to encourage their parishioners and congregation to make donations to food drives so that supplementing our nutrition programs. But there's always more to do, and it's a valid question. And I think it's one that's an appropriate challenge as I think the reality is, I think people have a tendency to think in this country that poverty is urban. And the churches are very much involved in the urban piece of this. I don't know how effective they have been in the rural areas. It's a good question.
Just one example, Hope Credit Union was started as a church project to bring access to responsible, affordable financial services to a community that was being essentially ignored by traditional banks. This was in 1995. Fast forward, the credit union has been one of the primary sources of access to financial services in the recovery of Hurricane Katrina. We, this week, will open new branches in Drew and Shaw, Mississippi, towns of less than 3,000 people. And this was started by a church, but the work didn't stop. With the churches didn't stop then. We really rely on faith-based institutions in these communities as influencers to help us connect with local residents. People go to churches looking for solutions. Fortunately, churches recognize that they're not lenders. You know, they're not healthcare providers. They have a certain role in helping people navigate their challenges. And part of that is developing more partnership, more collaboration with other resources that are able to address the specific challenges that people have. But I think connecting churches with service organizations, with solution providers, is a critical piece of the puzzle.
Go ahead.
Well, and I was just going to put up this, some of the rural churches are having some of the financial difficulties that other institutions are having. I grew up in a small town, less than 400 in population. Now it's a consolidated church organization with three other communities that are sharing a pastor. So you think about the resources that they have, similar to other rural institutions, you know, the faith-based institutions are having the similar challenges.
Yeah.
It's a question from our audiocast audience. This is from Professor Andrew Lamas at the University of Pennsylvania. Poverty cannot be adequately conceptualized or addressed without focusing on the production of income and wealth inequality. Why continue focusing on poverty without also pursuing policies that are not addressing growing inequality, particularly racial wealth inequality? Why continue to support a system that continually increases productivity, growth, and profitability without generating shared wealth? Any theory of poverty that does not address inequality is an impoverished theory.
Well, I think the professor may not fully appreciate the scope of agriculture in this country today. I think there's a tendency to think that there's only one kind of agriculture and one form of agriculture, and it's production agriculture, and that there are a small handful of people that are benefiting from agriculture. What we're seeing is a greater diversity within agriculture. Mm-hmm. And part of our Strike Force initiative is focused on empowering greater diversity, both in size, in method, and in operator. I think of a co-op that was formed by roughly 80 African-American farmers in Georgia that is now supplying on a regular basis greens, collard greens, to Walmart and other grocery stores in Georgia. Which we helped to start, which we helped to finance, and which was one of the first Strike Force programs and projects. So I think there is an understanding of the need to help people be more productive, to help people have opportunity. We're also looking at the at land availability. We're working, for example, with Florida A&M. When we closed an ARS lab, there was roughly 3,000 acres of land that was available that was connected to that lab. And we basically gave that land to Florida A&M, it's a minority serving institution, mm-hmm. with the proviso that they make it available for beginning farmers. So there's an opportunity there for access to land that might sometimes be difficult for beginning farmers. And then the last thing I would say is that's one of the reasons why we established the microloan program, mm-hmm. to provide an opportunity for people to get in this business without having to borrow or not being able to borrow hundreds of thousands of dollars. But we now at USDA have done over 18,000 of these microloans. And the theory behind that is that over time, those small local and regional food system producers are going to be able to expand and grow.
I would like to, though, comment. I think that the professor makes a very important point in that poverty is largely it's an income paradigm. We really need to also address asset development. And I think some of the strategies that USDA and some of the tools that USDA has and other federal agencies have can be incredibly important in allowing on-the-ground organizations to facilitate asset development. I talked about home ownership and the significant role it plays in an ability in stabilizing communities and building wealth. But you also have a post-recession, post-financial crisis environment where for many populations, and this is in Mississippi, for majority white borrowers, subprime mortgage lending is above where it was before the recession, 18%. Above where it was before the recession, but for African-American borrowers, prime mortgage lending is still 39% where it was below the recession. The amount of wealth that was lost, particularly in communities of color, is tragic. And so that affected people's credit scores, it affected their ability to access credit. And again, if you have assets in your home, then you can have equity that you can use for college loans, for a business loan, access to business credit for certain segments of the population. SBA lending for minority borrowers is significantly below where it was before the crisis. And so being able to finance businesses and homes that can generate wealth and help people stabilize their families and pass that wealth on to future generations is critical. And so I think asset development has to be a part of the strategy.
I'd also add an additional point on our loan programs for farmers. The ability to create wealth, obviously, in agriculture. Over 60% of our loans since I've been secretary have gone to beginning and socially disadvantaged producers. So there is an effort to try to utilize our programs to get people in a position where they can begin to have some accumulation of wealth, some accumulation of assets. And we, like Hope, we make loans to folks who the commercial banks would not otherwise lend to. Mm-hmm. And many of those loans are actually with no down payment. Mm-hmm. But yet, interestingly enough, during the recession, those loans performed better than the commercial bank loans.
We'll hear the next question.
Good morning. Ken Chesky with the Council for Agriculture, Science, and Technology. Kind of a question just to throw out to all three of you. And Jason, building upon your comments about the importance of experiential learning and getting young people involved, and kind of this question is about young people in communities, and there's kind of a natural tension occurs in these communities really between sometimes really the tension of often success for young people in rural communities is designed to getting them up and out of those communities versus the retention of the best and the brightest. Mm-hmm. And it kind of hits on this idea also that in terms of creating the attractiveness within rural communities is often hinged upon the availability of good paying jobs and livelihood. This other idea opposing upon that, the idea of entrepreneurship, and that in most rural communities, you know, you're not seeing Fortune 500 companies come in and set up. It's going to be often the entrepreneurship, the small businesses that create a lot of those types of opportunities. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we've necessarily been always successful as we could have been in terms of from the education standpoint of helping young people see the opportunities to stay and be a part of those communities and this area of entrepreneurship. And often our entrepreneurship focus have been, well, let's wait till they get a college education, then figure out how to get them back, versus starting early and providing those experiences, be it 4-H, FFA, other programs, other youth interventions that would get those students involved in that. I know Secretary Vilsack, you and I have had comments about this over the years, but kind of what are your thoughts in terms of how do we do a better job of incentivizing and preparing some of the best and brightest in these rural communities? Because I think one of the biggest things we suffer in rural America is this outward migration of talent. Mm-hmm. And not always necessarily the people that do stay, the abilities to then kind of create that kind of wealth. So,
mm-hmm. So what do you think, from my standpoint, there's a tremendous amount of opportunity there. And how do you attract and retrain? I grew up formative years, late 70s, early 80s. What was the message at the kitchen table in the mid 80s? My dad told me you better get really smart so you can get out of here, right? In there. I think that conversation is changing. I think that there's people are talking about opportunities in rural places, but now we gotta go to the next step. How do we go beyond just talking about it? How do we go about getting them to think about what are the opportunities that are happening here in rural places? I did a study a few years back when I worked at the Federal Reserve, looking at demographic moving patterns. And yes, people leave rural America when they hit 19. But what you even saw in the most remote rural communities, even out in, you can think about Western Kansas, when people hit the ages of 30 to 40 years old, there was a return migration of people into rural communities. How do we accentuate that? How do we encourage that by talking about the opportunities that do emerge? When I think a lot of it, kind of what you're coming and echoing, a lot of when people talk about retaining the best and brightest, a lot of times what I see in rural communities is they put up a bridge or a barrier at the end of the community to keep people from leaving, but it also keeps people out. And so how do we let people go, and how do we recruit them back by showing them some opportunities? And I think for rural communities, that means they have to tout their own horn. They have to be a little less humble and talk about their successes, because there are plenty of successes in rural communities that have grown great businesses over time, but do we really talk about it enough? And I think we have to also focus on not just having people be able to take a job, but we also have to focus on entrepreneurship. And so the last point I want to bring in is when we think about entrepreneurship, part of it is creative destruction. It does mean that new companies create new opportunities, but at the same time, they do put other companies out. And many times in rural communities, we lament the loss of that business on the downtown Main Street. But how do we create churn? and it's the movement of businesses in and out, in and out. And there are professors like Haltwinger out of Maryland that have looked at communities, and those that grow the fastest are often with the better jobs and growing incomes are those that foster churn. Yes, companies go out of business, but they're creating new companies behind it through innovations and doing those things. So how do we stimulate churn in rural communities?
This conversation just drives me crazy. Because you're absolutely right. We do not market the opportunities particularly well. Mm-hmm. I talk to our farm friends. I say, this is how you're trying to convince the next generation to farm. You're telling them that they're overworked, overtaxed, and overregulated. That's the message.
It is.
And you expect people to go, wow, you know, where do I sign up for that?
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of pointing out that they have the ability through agriculture to redefine the economy of the country into a bio-based economy instead of one that's dominantly reliant upon fossil fuels.
Yeah.
Instead of suggesting that they have the entrepreneurial opportunity of being able to start a local and regional food effort in their area that feeds the kids at school so that the kids understand where their food comes from so they have a greater appreciation for it. Instead of saying that they have the capacity to help this country deal with reduced greenhouse gas emissions and to mitigate and adapt the impacts of climate change, not just here, but around the world, mm-hmm. to feed an ever-increasing world population. Mm-hmm. That's going to happen in rural America. Instead of pointing out the fact that that they have the ability to produce this in great abundance that helps us export food to countries that do not have the capacity that helps to create jobs here. Mm-hmm. This is an interesting meeting we had in the White House as part of the Rural Council. Tom Perez, Secretary of Labor, and I met with a group of IT officials. And, you know, 10, 15 years ago, the theory was they were going to outsource a lot of the IT, the back room work on IT, the code writing and all that kind of stuff. They're going to outsource it to folks in other countries because it was going to be less expensive, and they were better prepared to do all of this. Here's what they learned, that it's not as efficient. And the reason it's not as efficient, when you're developing a game, you got to understand the culture of the people who are playing the game. If you don't understand the culture, you're going to make a mistake in the formulation of the game. Mm-hmm. And so what happened is that when they outsourced these jobs to folks in India and other places, they didn't understand the American culture, they didn't understand society, they structured these games in a way that they had to redo them. So now people are saying, you know what, the heck with that, let's bring them back home. Let's insource them. And the question is, where best to insource them? Well, rural America is a great place. Mm-hmm. You have reasonably priced real estate. Mm-hmm. Some of those downtown buildings that are empty could be filled with coders and writers of computer programming, could easily do that, so long as you've got the technology, the broadband, and the access, you can bring those jobs back. And in fact, they are coming back.
Right.
So there's a series of positive messages here that we and folks in rural areas have to understand. And the second point I would make is that rural folks have to stop focusing on trying to preserve the tax-supported institutions in their community mm-hmm. and create the tax-paying institutions. Yep. Because if they have tax-paying institutions, then the school will be supported, the hospital will be supported, all the social services will be supported. Mm-hmm. But there's a tendency to focus on trying to hang on to what you've got instead of trying to create new. And then the last point is, you know, immigration is not the enemy here. Immigration is not the enemy. Immigration is actually the entrepreneurship you're talking about. Mm-hmm. It's the next generation of people coming into this country with the hope and the dream of doing better for their kids, sacrificing, saving, working hard, doing the jobs that a lot of folks don't want to do, and building over time a more successful second, third, fourth, and fifth generation. And I think rural America needs to understand that there's a role to play in embracing and not being resistant to immigration.
Yep.
These are tough questions and tough issues and tough conversations to have mm-hmm. with folks, because you've got to tell them their mindset's got to turn around completely. It's not easy. But the communities that are doing this are the ones that create the churn, mm-hmm. are creating the vibrancy, are sending the message. And the young people say, well, shoot, I don't have to go to the big city. I can be a business owner right here. Or that couple that moved to the big city, trying to raise their kids, can't quite figure out why they spend 3 hours in traffic every day. Say, well, you know, that 3 hours, I could be in a small town, I could be home with my kids. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was governor, this issue really touched its own, because Iowa in 1900 had more people living in it than Florida and California combined in 1900. Then for the next 100 years, Iowa was the only state in the country that didn't at least double its population. I became governor, and for the first time in 70 years, we reversed the out-migration. Why? Because I went out to communities across the country. Do you know how hard it is to try to convince somebody in Phoenix, Arizona in January to come back to Iowa? But you know what? We showed them rush hour in Des Moines, like 12 cars. 15-minute commute. And we asked the question, what are you doing at 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning? Mm-hmm. Are you with your family or are you in a car? What are you doing at 5, 6, 7 o'clock at night? Are you with your family or are you in a car? We brought 1,000 families back from a variety of communities and appreciative. So you can market, you can make the case, and you can create a lot of energy, but you gotta have a positive attitude.
Yeah.
And that's sometimes not prevalent.
The only point I'd add is that it's really struck me over the years how actually smart rural people in low-income communities are. They do more with less than any of us. But they also have to make tough decisions. You want to be in a community where you can provide your child with a good education, where you can get a job that pays living wages, where you can have access to quality health care. And so I think the more we can be strategic about making investments that allow those rural residents to be comfortable that they can support their families and achieve, you know, not exorbitant quality of life, but a quality of life that allows them to live in an environment like the one the Secretary described. I think that everyone who steps back and thinks about it would rather live in a lower stress, have more space, breathe fresh air, the kind of lifestyle that you can realize in a rural area. But doing that in a way that allows you to support your family is a top priority. And so being strategic about making sure that we make investments that allow communities to do that, I think it should be a top priority for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Next question.
Good morning, Governor, Mr. Secretary. My name is Rudy Arredondo, President of the National Latino Farmers and Ranchers Trade Association. We are the only Latino farming and ranching organization in the United States, and we have over 75,000 members nationwide. One of the things that concerned me, Mr. Secretary, is in the 2008 Farm Bill, you know, you were charged with, you know, getting rid of all this discrimination lawsuits, and I wonder where we are. I know that we're still going to that, but we would like to see this off your table because it's impeding progress and it's creating a tremendous amount of not very good feelings, and you know that's not a good way to channel your energy. So that's one thing. The other thing is, you know, you're on your last leg with regard to your tenure, and so, you know, we would like to, at some point for you to consider addressing our organization. I'm sorry you couldn't attend to our 10th anniversary in Albuquerque, but you know, we are looking towards working with you because we have tremendous amount of interest and we have a tremendous amount of energy out there of people who want to do exactly what you said in terms of making sure that they have they continue to farm and ranch, because that's just part of our land-based culture, and to be able to do some real positive things for our communities. And with regard to, you know, your thing with credit unions, this is one thing that we would like to consider looking at, because sometimes we're not able to access because of some systemic clinks within the USDA Farm Service Agency. We would like to try to help you with that because some of those players are still there that created the issues that we're still trying to resolve. Thank you, sir.
First of all, I want to make sure that folks understand, there was not a direction in the 2008 Farm Bill to resolve the lawsuits and the complaints against the department. They were, in fact, not being handled at all in the previous administration. There was no resolution of any of them. There were pending class actions brought by African Americans, by Native Americans, and there were a series of individual claims that were not certified as a class action by the Supreme Court on behalf of Hispanic, Latino, and women farmers. None of that was being addressed, none of it. None of the systemic problems that gave rise to literally tens of thousands of those claims were being addressed. And in fact, the statute of limitations had run on a series of program complaints that had been made during the previous administration. So when I came in, my predecessor, Dan Glickman, and Ann Vedeman suggested that I pay attention to civil rights, that I focus on civil rights, that I try to address this issue. I can say that today, 7 years later, the African-American cases have been resolved. There is an issue of remaining money from the settlement that needs to be dealt with by the courts, but we have a proposal and the courts currently considering it, but all of the farmers have been paid. I can tell you that the Native American case has been settled and resolved, and there is, the only issue is, again, money that was left over from the settlement, how it's going to be handled. The courts are dealing with that, but checks have been sent. Over 3,000 Latino and Hispanic women farmers have received checks through a process that we established and set up voluntarily. We convinced the Department of Justice to participate in this. We have put in place, for the first time ever, a receipt requirement, so when people walk into the FSA office they ask for a loan or they ask for information, they get a receipt that acknowledges that they were in the office and what their nature of their business was. That's going to be a very sophisticated process. Once we get our computer programs set up. Right now they get a paper receipt, but they're going to get a lot more information. I can tell you that we have had a record low number of program complaints and a record low number of EEOC complaints within the department. We have significantly greater diversity in our hiring, and we have addressed to the extent that we can, the problems. Now, there are some folks who filed claims that did not get approved, and we didn't actually make those decisions. It was determined by an independent third party. We just had an OIG audit and review of that process, and they came back and said basically that it was a good process, that there were folks who were double counting, there were folks who were applying in a variety of different lawsuits that potentially were trying to get paid more than once. So I think on balance, we've done a pretty doggone good job of trying to address this issue, and I think we're in a much different place from a civil rights perspective than we were 7 years ago. Will there still be work to do? Absolutely, always. It's something you have to be vigilant about, and you have to have insurance that you have institutionalized that process. So we've had a cultural transformation within USDA. I track every month our hirings, I track every month the complaints, I track every month issues relating to civil rights so that I'm projecting to our team a commitment to civil rights. And I'd be more than happy to share with you more information about that if you're interested.
Next question.
Yes, with the comments about entrepreneurialism, one of the things that came to mind was whether you're an existing business or you're a new business and wanting to get started, broadband service is getting to be and is a continually a big thing in the rural communities. And I was kind of wondering, the question is, where are we on the development of the broadband services? What is happening with that? Because it is, you know, in the rural communities where we don't have the density of population and stuff, this is something that's getting quite big with the technologically driven agriculture we have today.
We are announcing actually today additional money under our Community Connect program being available for broadband expansion. I break this issue of broadband down into sort of two parts. One is access to broadband and then the speed and accessibility of the broadband. I think you could probably look at a map and you could probably see that access to some level of broadband has been expanded rather significantly in the last 7-8 years. I still think we have work to do on the speed of that broadband so that rural communities, rural entrepreneurs, rural business owners, farmers have access to not dial up, but that they have access to broadband that really gets them instantaneous information. The Recovery Act and the work of the USDA has expanded access to broadband to over 6 million families. It's expanded access to several thousand businesses and institutions that are located in rural areas. The FCC has created a process in which they are trying to encourage the telecoms to do more. We still have some concerns about that because of its impact on some of the smaller telephone companies, and we've communicated those concerns. But there is, I think, an effort to try to understand the need to get broadband. And I think we have to have the same attitude about broadband that we had about rural electrification. It's got to be sort of an understanding of the need not to leave anybody behind. And we've utilized wireless, we've utilized satellite, we've utilized cable. We've tried to work with the private sector. I think there's still more work to be done. The reality is I think we're also going to have to figure out ways in which we can encourage more infrastructure investment through infrastructure banks. That's why we were pleased with the Rural Opportunity Investment effort, again, part of the Rural Council. We've identified a $10 billion fund from CoBank and a number of the farm credit banks that are willing to invest in infrastructure. So we want to obviously encourage more of that activity.
Just one comment on broadband. We've really been excited about the opportunities that technology has to increase access to resources in places like the Delta. We've been really pushing the use of mobile banking. When those bank branches close in persistent poverty in rural areas, it is often difficult to invest in the bricks and mortar and personnel necessary to stand up a new branch. There are economic realities that you have to navigate, but almost everyone has a smartphone, not a cell phone, but disproportionately, rural people, low-income people, communities of color have smartphones at a higher rate than the general population. Again, as I said, poor people aren't dumb, they're poor, and they make very creative decisions about how to manage their limited resources, but they use those mobile phones for social media, for basic communications, for navigating the web, but they're disproportionately unbanked. We have been able to go into some of the most distressed places and get people signed up on mobile banking, and 36% of our members in our credit union didn't have a bank account before they joined HOPE. Now they're banked, they have access to non-predatory, affordable, responsible financial services, and these are in areas where we can't locate a branch, but they have a bank branch in their pocket. We're also doing some really exciting things with University of Mississippi Medical Center to try to bring telehealth into rural areas by locating kiosks in our branches. But the mobile banking, the use of these kiosks require high-speed telecommunications, so broadband is a critical game changer in rural communities.
The Secretary unfortunately has to leave us, so we're gonna have one more question, and then he has to depart for another meeting, but please stay because we do have other questions to keep the discussion going.
Good morning, my name is Joe Swedberg with recently retired from Hormel Foods and Farm Foundation trustee. But before I ask my question, I have to compliment Secretary Vilsack. I was in the audience many times when you came on, I called them your raiding parties to Minnesota, and we're recruiting. And I remember one time coming back to Austin and Governor Pawlenty was there and he wanted to know what I'd been doing. And I told him you were here recruiting. It got his attention, but it did work. I know we made some additional investments, so I just thought that was a very smart thing to do. My question is, as you look at the transfer of wealth that's coming, when you look at the average age of farmers being 58 and older, and you're gonna have trillions of dollars being transferred over the next number of years, mm-hmm. one way or another. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are and what the thinking is behind this and what can be done with regards to looking at a philanthropic effort through those dollars. There's going to be a lot of transfer of wealth mm-hmm. in one way or another. What are some of your thoughts from the panel on how that can be captured to help build rural America and address some of these issues?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question, and it is a question we've been asking at USDA about 6 months ago. Neil Hamilton, who's with the Drake Law School, came into my office and expressed concerns about this very topic. And he was expressing it from the standpoint of the land which will be transferred, it will go to people who are non-farmers, people who are living in cities, whose father and mother or whose aunt and uncle may have been farmers, but they've left and they don't have any interest in farming. The question is, what will their value system be? How well and interested will they be in investing in conservation, or will they be looking at maximum return in terms of cash rent, and how will that land be used as a result? So based on the conversation with Neo, we charged the Beginning Farmer and Rancher Advisory Committee to begin taking a look at this issue of land tenure. Who owns it? Who's going to own it? What are the ramifications on conservation, on wealth creation, on access to land for beginning farmers, and so forth? They came up with a number of recommendations for us as a department, and we are going to sort of amplify those recommendations later this fall in a series of conferences which I've asked our team to put together to sort of begin the process of addressing what the next administration will have to deal with. You know, we've dealt with a lot of issues in this administration, but they're always ongoing issues. And part of it is going to be having a basic understanding out in the countryside of this issue, having people confront it and think about it, having families talk about it in terms of precisely are they doing the estate planning that they need to be doing? Do they have a succession plan? Are they interested in creating opportunities for new and beginning farmers? And what kind of policies ought we consider as we look at a new farm bill that would help that? I've often said that farmers spend a great deal of time thinking about estate tax. And frankly, very, very, very few farmers and farm families ever pay estate tax. And if they do, it's because they have a really, really large operation, or it's because they didn't do the estate planning that they should have done.
Right.
So one thing is notifying them, get the estate planning done. The real tax problem, I think, in terms of this land tenure issue, is the income tax. Because today, 40% of land in America that's farmed is rented, which means that you've got 40% of land ownership today that's owned by folks like me, that aren't farmers but own farmland. The farm that my wife and I have has appreciated 6 or 7 times since we were fortunate enough to get it. Were we to sell it today to a beginning farmer, we would pay an enormous amount of tax. If we die owning it, our boys will get a stepped-up basis, and they can sell it the day after I die, or my wife dies, for no tax consequence at all, mm-hmm. not a single penny. So there's no incentive either for me to even think about selling the farm. That's going to have to be the boys' issue. But what if we created, within the income tax system, the ability to transfer your basis to a farmer, a beginning farmer, a returning veteran, someone who's truly interested in owning the land and having access to land? What if we were able to do that? Or create some kind of mechanism where I could discount the price to that beginning farmer and end up at the end of the day having more money in my pocket than if I just sold it to a farmer that's been around for 20 or 30 or 40 years who's built up equity. So I think we have to have that conversation. To figure out from a tax perspective what the barriers are. So we're going to have this conference to try to stimulate the conversation out in the countryside about this issue of land tenure. I could show you the sheet that's 4 or 5 pages long with all of the recommendations, and we're doing more work on our website. We're making loans more available. We're looking at our FSA microloan program and expanding it to ownership opportunities. We're looking at ways in which we can make sure that our ownership program facilitates transition issues. So we're looking at the programs we have and trying to make sure that they're adjustable and flexible to deal with this issue. But I think we have to have a much bigger conversation about this. That's a Great question.
I think we also need to look at community foundations and what's their role. In Nebraska, I know the Nebraska Community Foundation, when I was living in Omaha, was thinking about this issue, about the intergenerational transfer of wealth. And, you know, if we had just a small percentage that stayed in the community, what could you do? And I know one of the challenges is that when you have community foundations, you have small communities, so you have a small community foundation. So then how do you leverage and pull resources and think regionally to make the real investments that you need? Because you need some type of leverage and pooling of resources in order to do that. Otherwise, each individual foundation is so small, it's really hard to get that critical mass in order to do it. And then you run up to the Friday night rivalries, right? You know, your community beat me in 1938, so I'm not gonna partner with you today on making the critical investment. But how do you think about pooling those resources together, community foundations, to make those critical investments that it might be broadband or doing different things to make those investments?
Or even a conservation easement that prevents that land from being developed. Because a lot of this land is on the outskirts of expanding cities, and we will lose that land to production if there isn't some kind of mechanism to encourage conservation. So that can be part of the discussion. And that gets into foundations, it gets into the philanthropic piece of it. Can we link them up with the foundations that are purchasing these development rights, creating easements, 30-year easements, or within our own easement programs in the Farm Bill, can we have more aggressive use of those to preserve the land in farming, in addition to preserving the farmers?
Secretary, for being with us this morning, and please stay because we do have more questions and the conversation will continue.
Pleasure. Yeah. Thank you. So we're going with the next question.
Good morning. My name is Stephen Sugg with the Housing Assistance Council. And when you talk about rural persistent poverty, the maps for 30 years, you know, they look rather similar. They've changed a little bit, but we're very familiar with those regions as well. And I'm wondering if you all, from an academic perspective or from just a field-based perspective, have ever seen approaches to combat persistent poverty that work better, that particularly well in one region, maybe a tribal area or Appalachia, more than another region? And if so, what are they?
You know, I've found that addressing persistent poverty really needs focus, concentration on the conditions that exist in particular areas. The circumstances in Indian country are very different than circumstances in the Mississippi Delta. At one level, they're both extremely impoverished, but the infrastructure that's available for entrepreneurship, for the banking environment in rural and Indian country, again, is very different than it is in some parts of the Delta and across the Black Belt. That's the basis behind my recommendation that whether it's CDFIs like HOPE, whether it's community organizations, housing organizations, I think it's really critical that strategies be anchored in on-the-ground organizations that know those markets and that can target resources toward the needs that are most critical in those communities.
Right, and I would agree. I think it's focusing on each individual community. They have their own unique set of challenges. I kind of like to say, if you've seen one rural community, you've probably seen one rural community. And many different things happen in different places, and they're quite unique in the different challenges of those aspects of it. Some of them, it's infrastructure. And others, it might be skill sets of population, so they need educational training. And it might not be a four-year degree. It might be, how do we get them to 2-year community college training so they can be a welder, a tool and die maker on that aspect of getting the right skills for those jobs. And a lot of times what we have, and from what I see, is it's the skill mismatch. Local communities and rural communities, they have jobs, but the mismatch of employees in those communities to take those jobs. When I in Nebraska was talking to a rural manufacturer, he needed engineers. He needed people with those technical skills. Mm-hmm. He went out of state. He went down to Alabama and was recruiting people. He didn't tell them about the winter, but he was recruiting because he needed a certain skill set. And so a lot of times it's going to be region by region based, community by community based, and depending on what those local and regional needs are is really going to shape and drive the strategy for reducing child poverty.
Yeah, I would also say that regardless of where you're located, it's also clear that no single sector, no single organization can solve these problems by themselves. It really requires comprehensive strategies. We talked about faith-based institutions, community mm-hmm. colleges, educational institutions. In the Deep South, there's a large number of historically black colleges and universities. The capacity and resources available to those institutions are significantly less than they are to larger, better supported institutions, but they're still critical sources of education and expertise that can be leveraged. And so taking advantage of the assets that exist in each community is absolutely critical, and doing it across public, private, nonprofit sectors, I think is gonna be necessary to get traction on addressing rural poverty.
Mm-hmm. Next question.
Hello, my name is Megan Messina. I'm coming here from Montana State University, a very rural mm-hmm. area. Mm-hmm. I guess I have a pretty general macroeconomic issue. I've done a lot of experiencing in my 25 years. I've worked since I was very young. I've been involved with a lot of different people, school systems, hospitals, Indian reservations. I've been the lunch lady for a week or two working with kids. I'm also a farmer. I was out there this morning at 5 a.m. My hands are never clean enough for society. My issues is that I've been to a lot of conferences in D.C., and I sit and listen to everybody's issues. They're very complex and very dynamic. Science is advancing. I just got done from being at AAAS at the Ronald Reagan Building last week. And so this is my issue. So poverty is an issue, and a lot of other things are issues. I just don't see us combating or making any strides, any progression forward without solid, sound nutrition. And I don't want to say it's late for adults, but, you know, kids is what we need to target. And so I've worked with a lot of kids, and they don't think farming is very cool. They don't make very much money. You have kids that look at a cucumber in the ground, and they call it a pickle. They don't know it's a cucumber. My biggest thing is, I don't even know if this is a term, but social infrastructure. Mm-hmm. It's not really in place in this country for a conducive, good, you know, day by day, daily, good, nutritious living. It's just, I'm a month away from being a registered dietitian. It mm-hmm. is really hard for me to do it as an active 25-year-old person. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine how a kid does it, let alone their families. I've also moved 10 times in the past 13 months, and I've lived with a variety of people. People just don't have time, and without time, they don't appreciate food. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you think about food, food is the basis of somebody. You want things to churn in small towns. You want mm-hmm. you want churn and inertia. That takes movement and action. When I eat bad for a week, I get sluggish and don't move and don't mm-hmm. want to move, and I'm not doing anything for society. So I kind of... it's interesting, everybody, you know, we talk and there's lots of policies in place, and I really do appreciate everybody trying and trying and trying. But to really move the pendulum and to swing things in a positive way on the food side, mm-hmm. I'm kind of at a loss. I don't understand how we expect to get anything done without, especially our children, growing up with good nutrition. I mean, mm-hmm. I literally don't physically move or mm-hmm. or think, for that matter, with bad food. Mm-hmm. So when I go to a kitchen at a school and I see the kids served with number 10 cans with queso cheese that's like 30 ingredients long, mm-hmm. I just don't get it. And then I'm seeing kitchens that scratch cook, and it's awesome. And the kids like it. They make their sauce, not out of number 10 cans. They take eggplants, onions, zucchini, squashes. They buy it in the season with the farmers markets, and then they mix it up and they serve it on pizza, and the kids don't notice the difference. A kid might say, "What's that mushroom doing in there?" Just don't worry about it. But and what really blows my mind is that there's no education classes, no nutrition education classes. like a solid nutrition class in the public school system. I don't understand. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to get anything done when the nutrition is just very lacking and childhood mm-hmm. obesity is such a major problem. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's a question or a comment.
No, and so I think in my thoughts on that is you're right. I mean, when you look at kids, when they go to school, if they're hungry, they're not learning. And I think about when, how many schools have brought in backpack programs? Just so that the kids, when they go home on the weekend, they have something to eat. So when they come back in on Monday, they have food in their stomachs. Or how many of them have breakfast programs and feeding kids so they have some type of food and meal and doing different things. I think the change in the people are focusing is different because I think a lot of our conversation has been food. And maybe it's just because I'm in a university setting where food science is working with the nutrition department on a whole bunch of different type of projects and programs, where the focus is now not just on food and the quantity, but on more of changing the focus in the conversation on nutrition, on how do we enhance nutrition on doing different aspects of it. It takes a while. I think people are now more interested in food than ever. How many people know what have at least heard of the word local foods? Right? 5 to 10 years ago, would have anybody been using those words? So I think we're embarking on a time frame where people are re-engaging with food. I think that they're thinking about health, and they're thinking about obesity and all the issues from the food side of it to the exercise side of it to all these different things. So I think the opportunity is now, and it's a ripe opportunity to have that conversation and to incorporate it. So hopefully you don't get dejected and throw up your hands and walk away that people are not re-engaging with food and the conversation
is
changing.
I never do that. Yeah. No.
But I think that it is starting to have, and those conversations are starting to emerge. You know, could we be better? You bet. But I think they are starting to work on that.
I'd also bring back to the comprehensive nature of and issues that affect and relate to poverty. I very easily could have put a map up here of food deserts, and it would have significantly overlapped with high poverty areas. Mm-hmm. So I think talking about poverty doesn't just diminish the importance of nutrition. One of the things that we have been very involved with is financing healthy food outlets in rural areas. There are many of these communities that don't have a fresh food retailer, and so making strategic investments in those sorts of community infrastructure is just as vital as creating jobs, as supporting schools. If you're not healthy, you're not going to be productive. As you said, you get sluggish. We see that in communities. And if you have to rely on fast food as your primary source of nutrition, you're going to lose ultimately. And so I think being comprehensive in the strategies, not just nutrition, not just education, not just health, not just jobs, but we've got to take a broad strategic approach to tackling poverty at every level.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay. Question from our audiocast audience. This is from Beth Archer at Agra Institute. Mm-hmm. Is there data that suggests that rural community development advancement are proportionally related to links with urban centers? What is the relationship between urban leaders connecting with rural communities to lift up entire regions? Mm-hmm. Are there models where success has occurred, and do not urban centers need rural communities to be strong?
Mm-hmm. I would say absolutely. Back when we were getting organized in the early years of HOPE in the late 90s, mm-hmm. We conducted a study that looked at commuting patterns. It's clear that while Memphis is technically not in the Delta, Memphis drives much of the economy of the north part of our service area. Okay. Similarly, in Mississippi, Jackson is the largest market, mm-hmm. and you cannot disconnect the importance of urban areas from rural areas. I was at a recent meeting in North Carolina that showed housing concentration, housing patterns over the decades since the late 30s, and you see an increasing urbanization, sprawl around the major urban areas, and the rural areas are shrinking, but the interrelation, the commuting, the people move back and forth between those communities, and they rely heavily on each other. The importance of providing suppliers, companies that provide services in to urban markets and locating those in rural markets is a great opportunity that's, I think, underutilized. Clearly, the connection between food and urban areas is undeniable. I think it's very easy to use the urban boogeyman, but I think if we are smart, we can't disconnect the linkage between urban and rural areas.
Right. I think in future success going forward, urban and rural, they have been connected throughout time, and they'll always be connected. But they play a different role in that hierarchy within that economy and a different purpose of it. And so we need to strengthen those ties between them in many different ways. And I think if you play urban against rural, I think both are going to lose.
Yeah.
We have to think about an integrated regional perspective about their economies are already linked. You just check on commuting patterns, as you've indicated. And so how do you take the strengthen those ties between urban and rural communities?
Ask a second question. My name, again, is Jim Webster, journalist. 50 years ago, I was the managing editor of a little daily newspaper, Madison, South Dakota. The Johnson administration started the war on poverty. We created, or our community created, a community action program, community action agency. Many other communities in rural areas did the same thing. A lot of times over the resistance of the county boards of commissioners who wanted to make sure that their institutions stayed rather than solving war. Well, if Johnson declared war on poverty 50 years, 52 years ago, it looks like poverty won, or we wouldn't be here today talking about what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward a few years, came to Washington in 1972, right before I started working in the Senate. Congress passed the Rural Development Act of 1972, created an undersecretary instead of an assistant secretary for rural development, and said this undersecretary will be the lead person in the federal bureaucracy in charge of all the rural areas. Fast forward again till 7 years ago, Tom Vilsack comes to the office, and he's got to recreate the same thing. We're talking about a whole bunch of programs. And Bob Dole, when he was before he was in the Senate, I think, or before he was a presidential candidate, used to say, people have problems, we have programs, and they don't all meet. How are we going to get these programs to match up with the needs of the people out there?
So I think that's very true in terms of we have a lot of different programs for a lot of different issues that we have out there. I think if you're going to match up programs with what's happening in the community, I think it starts with community conversations. I think it's focused on capacity building, and it starts with assessing your community and what are the issues and challenges that you're going to address. It's about creating a vision for what you want your community want, what you want it to be, and getting people to buy in at the very local grassroots level on what they're going to do to address the issues. If there is no local buy-in on what to address in terms of the local issues, we can create as many programs as we want at the federal, state, or any other level, and they're not going to work. Because at the end of the day, when you talk about poverty within communities, it's very local, it's very individual, and it's very grassroots. And if we don't get that grassroots buy-in, the programs, they can be great programs, they're never going to have the impact and difference it is. And so I think a lot of it of what we need to do in communities and various different things is how do you think about creating community conversations. We've been working now over the last year with another program from the state of Indiana. It's called Hometown Competitiveness. We've only focused on 6 or 7 communities. And how do you focus on issues? And what are you going to address? and realizing that you can't address everything, but so what's the one thing that you're gonna leverage on and do? One community was Corydon, Indiana. It was the original state capital of Indiana. What they decided what they wanted to address was their downtown, or the disappearance of their downtown. They decided that they were going to do a downtown revitalization. It's been a year now. They've raised, I think it's $750,000 for a really small community with a target of a $1 million, and making redevelopment type of progress and perspectives of where it is. But it was about grassroots community conversations, identifying where their assets were, what things that they could do going forward, and deploying them, and making sure that they knew what was happening at the federal level, at the state level, and with philanthropics and with other organizations to pull the resources that are already out there to help their particular issue. But I think, from my belief, it starts grassroots, having those community conversations and getting that local buy-in.
I think another element of that is a point that I've made a couple of times. I think, you know, there's not necessarily a shortage of programs. I mean, there are programs out the wazoo. The challenge is how those programs are implemented, connecting those resources with real needs on the ground. The issue that the gentleman referenced earlier with the Black Farmers lawsuit is an illustration of how resources didn't reach those who needed it most. We shouldn't take a lawsuit. I think it turns on leadership and setting priorities. I'm really encouraged that the secretary mentioned an effort to try to target community facilities funds, which is a significant tool and a very flexible tool that can be used for housing, for businesses, for addressing a range of needs, healthcare facilities in rural areas, but those resources now run through community, the planning and development districts, local organizations that are often controlled by the traditional powers that be, that don't necessarily reflect the demographics of the community. And so broadening access to those resources so that organizations that have a finger on the pulse of the communities and that have a track record of directing resources where they're needed most is at least one possible solution to targeting resources in a more effective way. Again, I'm encouraged with some of the things that the secretary is trying. I hope that can happen at a significant scale while he's still in office, and that it's something that future administrations will build on.
I think we've exhausted our questions for this morning's forum. We haven't exhausted the questions on the issue of poverty or the need to discuss this more, and we will look forward to doing so at future forums. Our next forum is the 22nd of June, and please join me in thanking Dr. Henderson and Mr. Bynum for being with us today.
Thank you.